much of humanity is driven by some combination of the desire to make a lot of money and the desire to be recognized, known, and remembered in some way, shape, or form long after their time here on Earth has come to an end. It is believed that part of the reason for those desires is that people inherently quest for immortality. The unfortunate thing, however, is that, as we touched on in last week's episode on Stanislav Reshetnikov, some people seem to either lose the narrative of being remembered for positives, or they simply pass a point that they believe is of no return, and they decide that being remembered for anything is better than not being remembered at all. This week, we're going to look at a story of a young man who was known to be quiet, reserved, and mostly a shadow to those that he lived near and went to school with. His story is one of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and complete boredom that led to what appeared to be a well-thought-out plan to commit an unthinkable deed, then throw an incredible party, and finally be remembered around the world. He did perhaps wind up with all of those things, but he will likely also spend the rest of his life in prison, and that too will always be a part of his legacy. Hello, my name is Lance, and welcome to episode 124 of Gone But Never Forgotten, Being Remembered for Parricide, The Murders of Blake and Mary Jo Hadley. Tyler Hadley was born on February 16th of 1994 in Port St. Lucie, Florida, to his parents Blake and Mary Jo Hadley. Blake and Mary Jo also had one other son, an older brother to Tyler, named Ryan Hadley. From seemingly all accounts, Tyler and Ryan had a very stable and rather unremarkable upbringing, and everyone said that the family of four was very close. Blake and Mary Jo had moved to Port St. Lucie from Fort Lauderdale before the two boys were born so that they could be closer to Blake's parents, who lived in nearby Stuart, Florida. Blake would take on a job working as a watch engineer at the St. Lucie nuclear power plant, and Mary Jo was an elementary school teacher who was seemingly loved by everyone that attended her school. It has been said that regardless of one's struggles, Mary Jo never gave up on a student, even when everyone else seemingly did. I feel that it's pertinent to talk here about Port St. Lucie itself, because I do feel that the place actually played a part, even if small, in the series of events that led to the true crime story that we will get to here in a minute. In the 1950s, the land that would eventually become Port St. Lucie, which today is actually the seventh most populous city in Florida with a population around 205,000, was almost entirely uninhabited. At that point, the area pretty much consisted of a fishing camp, a few farms and businesses, and not a whole lot more going on. The land itself was very swampy, and many believed that it was not, and would not, be suitable for large settlement. In 1958, however, all of that would change when the General Development Corporation, or GDC, purchased about 40,000 acres, or 160 square kilometers, of land along the North Fork of the St. Lucie River, and in 1959 they opened their first bridge over the St. Lucie River, which allowed for direct vehicle access to Port St. Lucie for the first time. Frank Elliott and Robert Mackel, who owned GDC, very astutely realized that there was an aging population and that there was a large exodus of retirees from across the United States and elsewhere to Florida. And so they purchased the land with the belief that they would massively cash in by providing a new place and a cheaper place for retirees to move to and plan to move to. GDC would subdivide much of the land that they purchased into plots that measured 80 by 125 feet, and then they placed full-page ads in places like Life magazine and in Newsweek. Then those ads promised that the area would fulfill the Florida dream. The caveat was that even though the ads showed the idealistic retirement life, they themselves represented a dream, because most of the area was literally still a swamp. However, as many of us can understand, especially nowadays, the price was right. The plots of land could be purchased for only $10 down and $10 a month in perpetuity. To put that in perspective, in today's money, that would be roughly only $104 down and $104 per month. Those would be payments for the rest of your life, but still a lot cheaper than other retirement homes and retirement communities were offering at the time. The city itself would grow immensely and would see the population reach 15,000 by 1980 and 165,000 by 2010. At the height of the real estate boom in the United States and Florida, Port St. Lucie was the fastest growing city in the United States. All of this to say, Port St. Lucie as a city still remained and remains as more of a retirement hub than anything. And even though the area is filled with shops and things to do on the inside, there is not a lot for younger generations to do outside and outside of business hours. Port St. Lucie actually became a massive hub for marijuana grow-ups, and by extension of that, a lot of people who were involved in the drug trade. Port St. Lucie even started to become known as Pot St. Lucie, a little tongue-in-cheek, but also a very real look at how the city was seen by those living inside and outside of the city. Even though the city was essentially created and built for retirees, nowadays the demographics have indeed changed, even though the surroundings have not. As of the 2000 census, over 30% of households had children under the age of 18, and 25% of the population was made up of people under the age of 18. And so, as you can imagine, with parks that were off limits at night, neighborhood watches that were not afraid to call the police at a moment's notice, and a growing teenaged population, Port St. Lucie became known for house parties that were filled with a lot of partiers under the age of 21, and parties that had plenty of drugs and alcohol available for anyone that wanted to partake in those types of things. As I alluded to earlier, neighbors and friends of the Hadley family said that the Hadley family was seemingly always very close. Tyler would even stay up late often and wait for Blake to get off work on the night shift at the power plant, and the two would often be seen playing basketball for hours, often until midnight, and having a great time together. The family was also often seen having fun together in the family pool. However, as Tyler reached high school and his world opened up, people started to notice a change in Tyler. He got quieter, even though he had always been reserved, and he became much more unpredictable, and his entire demeanor was said to have changed. Friends would say that Tyler had a very strange personality, in the sense that he could go from quiet to entirely too hyper in just a moment. The often reserved boy would start to seek out an audience at a moment's notice and start to crack jokes, make noises, or simply start laughing loudly for attention. Friends said that Tyler started to smoke marijuana regularly in his freshman year of high school, and that parents started to restrict their own children from hanging around Tyler for fear that they would be influenced and would fall into the same traps that Tyler was seemingly falling into. One neighbor of the Hadleys said that she had tried on numerous occasions to also speak to Mary Jo about Tyler and his struggles, but seemingly for quite a few years, Mary Jo lived in denial, even saying on many occasions that Tyler did not even do drugs, even though it was increasingly evident to seemingly everyone else around the family that he was. Tyler's descent seemingly continued from there, with him starting to delve into harder drugs and starting to skip school regularly. He also started to develop quite a rap sheet over his teenage years. Tyler had been in trouble and known to police for using, buying, and selling drugs, and he had also been detained on numerous occasions for things like arson, vandalism, theft, and even aggravated battery. It was clear that Tyler was descending into the life of a person struggling with addiction and slipping more and more into crime alongside of that. Over the years, Tyler would seemingly joke with friends often, in person and online, about killing his parents. Usually, though, that would come up after he was punished for something or after he had a fight with either Blake or Mary Jo. Friends said that they never truly believed that Tyler would harm his parents because when things were good between he and his family, he was seen as a lucky young man who had a full and loving family. Many friends over the years would calm Tyler down by telling him that it was normal to be angry at one's family and that he likely just needed some space and some time to calm down. It did become evident over time, though, to many of the people in Tyler's life that he was suffering from some severe mental health issues, because it seemed that when he wasn't drunk or high, he was complaining and threatening to kill either his parents or himself. Likely because of all of that, Mary Jo, ever the believer in everyone, especially her son, knew that she needed to take a step for Tyler, because she knew that she was running out of time to help him as he was quickly approaching his 18th birthday. In June of 2011, Tyler came home from his friend Desiree's house, where, in his words, he had been completely blitzed out of his mind, and his parents made the decision that they were going to help him, whether he liked it or not, for his own good. Tyler would be admitted to New Horizons, which was a mental health clinic, by his parents, and he was forced to attend counseling there daily. The reason that I mention Tyler's age here is that Tyler's parents were able to enact what is called the Baker Act, which is an act under Florida law that allows for parents to commit their children into involuntary psychiatric treatment if they are under the age of 18. The Baker Act is only able to be used if the parents believe that the child will cause serious bodily harm to themselves or to other people in the near future. Now, this could certainly be a sign that threats had been made against Mary Jo and Blake or others by Tyler, but when a coworker asked Mary Jo if she believed that Tyler may ever hurt her, Mary Jo told the co-worker that she was only worried that Tyler may hurt himself or take his own life because of depression or while he was under the influence of something. Mary Jo herself had struggled with depression, and she was worried that Tyler may in fact be suffering from depression as well, and he had already been previously helped for depression, an eating disorder, and also low self-esteem. The wonderful thing was that Mary Jo was very vocal with her friends just 2 weeks after Tyler came home from New Horizons. She said that she felt as though Tyler was being more like himself, and that she felt like he was over the hurdle of everything that he had been struggling with. Tyler even traveled with his father and paternal grandfather on the weekend before the grisly events that are coming. Tyler's grandfather said that the trip and the family reunion that they attended was wonderful, and that there didn't seem to be any indication that Tyler was struggling or having any problems at home. However, whether things were better or not, something was on Tyler's mind, and it was actually something that he had talked about weeks and even months before he put his plan into action. Tyler had told friends in the past, when he had talked about killing his parents, that he also planned to throw a huge party after he did it. He said that nobody had ever murdered their parents before, and then threw a party while the bodies were still inside of the home. It seemed to be a sick fantasy of Tyler's that he had put more thought into than just a few moments, or even a few days. On July 15th of 2011, Tyler and his parents went out to dinner as a family, and they stopped at a convenience store on the way home, and while there, Tyler ran into a friend of his, Cameron Adams. Cameron said that when he saw Tyler there, Tyler seemed like he was in a good mood. Cameron had mentioned to Tyler that it was his birthday, and Tyler wished him a happy birthday, and then proceeded to tell Cameron to come to his place the following night because he was having a party and they could celebrate together. Tyler had talked about throwing a party at his house on numerous occasions over the years, but nobody ever seemed to take him seriously. First of all, most people knew that Tyler was not quote-unquote popular enough to have a big party and have a lot of people turn up for it. But also, everyone that knew Tyler, even a little bit, knew that his parents were incredibly strict and that there was no way that they would allow for Tyler to have a party. The only way that anyone could imagine Tyler having a party at all was if his parents were out of town, and seeing as Cameron saw Mary Jo and Blake in that store, he knew that they were not out of town. Word had actually been getting out all week that Tyler was bragging again that he was going to have a party. When people would ask Tyler if the party was still a go as the day got closer, Tyler would simply respond that he was working on it. Everyone generally assumed that that meant that the party was off and that his parents had put the kibosh on it. At 11:25 a.m. though, on July 16th, Tyler would have a conversation with his friend Antonio Ramirez on Facebook. Tyler said, "Sup, brah?" Antonio said, "Chillin', what you doing tonight?" Tyler said, "Trying to have a party at my crib." Antonio said, "Your parents ain't home?" And Tyler said, "Nope, well, they are leaving soon." At 1:15 p.m., Tyler would post on Facebook, quote, "Party at my crib tonight, maybe," unquote. As you can clearly see, everything seemed to be very wishy-washy, even at just after 1 p.m. in the day. Tyler clearly had the motions moving within his mind to have a party, and what he would need to do for that to happen, but everyone seemed to see through it, and figured that this was once again just Tyler being Tyler. However, at 8:15 p.m., just 7 hours later, Tyler again posted to his Facebook wall, and he said, quote, "Party at my house. Hit me up," unquote. One of his friends messaged him and was shocked and asked Tyler what would happen if his parents came home. And Tyler responded by saying, quote, "They won't. Trust me," unquote. Word spread around Port St. Lucie quickly, and the word on the street was that the party was going to either be awful or incredible, because the kid that was throwing the party wasn't really known by any of the usual suspects that attended house parties. The real question what had happened in the 7 hours between Facebook posts to go from complete uncertainty to certainty of a party. When Blake and Mary Jo arrived home in the afternoon on July 16th of 2011, Tyler would take his parents' phones to ensure that neither one of them could make a phone call for help once he started in on his plan. Then, just before 5 p.m., he would take 3 ecstasy pills, and he locked the family's Labrador into a closet because he believed that when he started to attack his parents, the Labrador would turn on him. He then listened to a song by one of his favorite rappers to hype himself up. He took the ecstasy because he was worried that if he was not on drugs, he would not follow through on his plan. Tyler then went into the garage, and he found a claw hammer, and then walked into the family room at the home where Mary Jo was working on the computer, and he stood behind her for approximately 5 minutes, just watching her and thinking about what he was about to do. He then came right up behind Mary Jo and attacked her by hitting her in the back of the head with the claw end of the hammer. As he started to attack Mary Jo, she started to scream, and she started to scream asking him why. Hearing the screams of his wife, Blake, who was in the master bedroom, came barreling towards the family room, and he was completely unprepared for what he saw when he got there, as there was a grisly scene from Tyler attacking his mother. Blake and Tyler reportedly locked eyes for a long moment as Blake was clearly in shock, and then Blake also asked Tyler why he would do what he was doing. Tyler then said that he responded with, quote, "Why the F not?" and he proceeded to keep asking his father that question as he beat his father to death as well with the claw end of the hammer. Tyler then says that when it was over, he wrapped towels around the heads of Blake and Mary Jo, and he dragged both of their bodies down the hall and into the master bedroom, leaving the two bodies lying there face down, and he left the hammer lying on the ground between the two of them. Tyler said that it then took about 3 hours for him to clean up most of the blood and gore that was left from the two attacks, and then he proceeded to bury the bodies of his parents under broken dishes, shattered glass, bloody towels, pillowcases, books, a coffee table, a mop, Clorox wipes, and an entire canister of coffee grounds. Tyler would later say that he threw all evidence and anything else that reminded him of his parents on top of their lifeless bodies in that bedroom. Tyler then said that he took a shower to clean himself up for the party, and he looked at himself in the mirror for a long time and just laughed. Tyler then would take his parents' credit cards and go on a buying spree, being caught on ATM cameras, withdrawing money, and then he drove around and picked up a few of his friends. I don't know whether it's the fact that this was a young man who was not fully matured, or simply because he had done drugs on that day and a lot of drugs leading up to that day. But the total disregard with which he treated his parents and the way that he went about his day and his plans for his party without seemingly a second thought really rattles me. Obviously, we do know that killers, especially serial killers, are able to compartmentalize and even lead two lives. But this is a 17-year-old boy who committed 2 murders and seemingly just moved on with his life. The party really got started around 11 p.m. and a lot of people showed up. As mentioned, Port St. Lucie didn't have a lot going on a Saturday night, and so as word spread, kids kept showing up. By about midnight, there were already about 60 kids inside of Tyler's house, and most of them admittedly didn't even know who Tyler was. However, that wasn't going to stop them from having a good time in a place that was open to the public. Inside of the house, bottles were broken, cigarettes were put out on the carpet, and everything was treated with complete and utter disregard. Tyler, for his part, didn't seem concerned at all with the destruction of the house. He was only overheard telling people to smoke inside the house and to stay inside the house because of fears that the neighbors would call the police and put an end to the party. Throughout the party, Tyler told a couple of people that he had killed his parents, and that was why he was able to have the party. But it seemed for the most part that these confessions were just disregarded as the weird kid looking for attention again and making up stories. However, other people did notice weird things like stains on the floor, and stains on the computer keyboard that were brown, and stains by the master bedroom of the house. However, most people just assumed that it was someone's beer or soda that had been spilled. These kids didn't seem to care too much about what was going on around them, just more happy to have something to do and somewhere to be on a Saturday night. Throughout the party, attendees even remembered a distinct smell, and some people were saying that they smelled dead bodies. When people asked Tyler where his parents were, he would give different answers, even when he didn't say that he killed them. He told one friend that they were on vacation in Georgia, and then told another person that they had gone to Orlando. He even told one friend that Blake and Mary Jo didn't even live in that house and that the house was his alone. At the peak of the party, there was roughly 100 kids partying, and ironically, the only time at the party that Tyler seemed to actually get mad about anything is when one of the kids brought a mailbox into the house and started to swing it around. Tyler yelled at the kid and told him that stealing a mailbox was a felony, and insisted that people put the mailbox back on the neighbor's yard where it was stolen from. Whenever I read things like this in research, it always blows me away. It's such a small thing, but imagine being consumed by the fact that someone stole the neighbor's mailbox while partying with 100 kids to celebrate the fact that you had murdered your family. I think that things like this really show how skewed the human mind can be. I understand that at this point, Tyler was consumed with the fear of the police coming and putting an end to the party, but man, when you put it into perspective, it's truly insane what goes through the mind of a killer. When one of Tyler's friends, Mark Andrews, went to leave the party, Tyler spoke to him, and he told him privately that he may be going to prison because he had killed someone. Mark looked at him and frankly told Tyler that if he had actually killed someone, that was his business, and Mark didn't want to know or hear anything about it. Tyler then proceeded to tell people that he was going away to prison for life and that he was going to kill himself. Finally, he found his friend, Michael Mandel, and he asked Michael if they could go for a walk so that they could speak privately. Tyler and Michael had been best friends since they were 8 years old. As the two walked down the block, Tyler told Michael that he had killed both Blake and Mary Jo, and of course, Michael, knowing his friend, did not believe him. Tyler pressed on, though, and pointed out to Michael that both of his parents' vehicles were still in the driveway. When Michael still didn't believe him, he showed Michael a bloody footprint that he had left in the garage, and then he actually took Michael into the master bedroom, where he saw the pile of debris and parts of two bodies buried underneath. Michael rushed away in a hurry, but did not leave the party right away. There was even a photo of Michael and Tyler that was taken after Michael saw the bodies of the two, and the two were standing side by side and clearly wearing the mental anguish of the fact that there were two dead bodies in that home. Around 2 a.m., someone announced that there was another house party in town, and a large percentage of the people that were there rushed out of the house, and the neighborhood was swept up in the noise of squealing tires and kids leaving in a hurry. One neighbor had enough with the sudden blast of noise and the fact that some boys had found their way onto her yard and were looking in her windows, and so she called the police. The police attended the scene, now with only about 20 kids left at the party, and after speaking briefly with Tyler, they left. Around 2:30 a.m., some of Tyler's friends started to filter back to his house to continue partying because they found out that the other party was a lie. Michael Mandel, meanwhile, had grabbed 10 Percocet pills that Tyler had planned to use to commit suicide, and he hid them in a hallway closet so that Tyler couldn't find them, and Michael left the party. At 4:40 a.m., Tyler posted to Facebook again, quote, "Party at my house again. Hit me up," unquote. The party that seemed like it was never going to end, though, came to an abrupt end right about then, because the police were outside the door of the house, having been tipped off by Michael, who had called Crime Stoppers and told them everything. Two officers watched on inside of the house to get a gauge for what was going on, and then knocked on the door. Tyler answered, and his eyes were wide, and he appeared to certainly be under the influence of something. Tyler said that his parents were out of town, and he refused to allow the police access to the home. He had one hand hidden behind his back, and officers drew their weapons and ordered him to put his hands above his head and then to get on the ground. Tyler was shackled in the driveway as the two officers entered the home, with Tyler screaming at them that they could not go in the house. The house, of course, was a complete disaster after the party, and the officers made their way through the home and found that everything that Michael had reported to Crime Stoppers was true. Tyler was arrested at the scene and charged with the murders of both of his parents, Blake Hadley and Mary Jo Hadley. Because Tyler was a minor at the time that he committed both murders, he was unable to be sentenced to death as per Florida law. He was instead sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole in 2014 when he pleaded no contest to two counts of first-degree murder. In April of 2016, though, Tyler's sentence was overturned on appeal because the appeal judge said that when Tyler was sentenced, the courts did not consider an alternative to the life sentence. A recent case, Miller versus Alabama, had recently changed how juvenile murderers were to be treated in the U.S. judicial system. In December of 2018, Tyler Hadley was back in court for a resentencing hearing that took place over 6 days. Judge Gary Sweet decided at the end of that the life sentence for Tyler Hadley was, in fact, the correct sentence. He said that the crimes that Tyler committed were heinously atrocious and that they were the product of much premeditation. The prosecuting attorney, Tom Bacadal, said, quote, "If Tyler Hadley doesn't deserve life in prison, then no one does. So we're pleased and we hope that the Hadley family finds some peace," unquote. The change from life without parole to a life sentence does mean that Tyler is able to get a review after serving 25 years in prison, meaning that he will be up for his first review around the time that he is 42 years old. He is currently imprisoned at the Okeechobee Correctional Institution, which is a prison for men in Okeechobee, Florida. This case certainly serves in my mind as a reminder of just how sick the human mind can be, and just how important it is that we look after and seek help wherever possible for mental health problems. I don't know what it is like for you where you live, but sadly where I live, a lot of the people and places and programs that were put into place to help those suffering from mental health problems have been shut down. We live in this world where we say that mental health is better recognized than ever before, but much like in the case that I covered 2 weeks ago laid out, so is a thing like racism. Knowing more about the ills of society does not mean that we are dealing with them or even equipped to deal with them properly. Cutting programs when we should be adding programs simply seems to ensure that many more people who are sick and many more people who are struggling with mental health and a myriad of other problems are not able to access the help that they so dearly need. For me, personally, I have a deep-rooted faith in God and a belief that while times get really tough, even between my ears at times, He is here with me. Something that I'm learning, slowly, mind you, in my life, is that I can control a lot of the thoughts and a lot of the doubts and a lot of the darkness that goes on around me and even creeps into my own life because of my faith. I'm going to take a step and try to make that a little bit more of this podcast because I believe that in a world of dark, there is light to be had in faith for anyone who seeks it. A verse that actually really resonates with me as I try to overcome the darkness on a day-to-day basis is found in 2 Timothy 1, verse 7 in the Bible, and it says, quote, "For the Spirit that God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline." Unquote. I try to live that truth every day of my life to keep at least some of the darkness at bay. I know that if I try hard enough, I am strong enough to ensure that I stay as positive as possible, and so can you. According to the World Health Organization, as of 2019, around 970 million people were struggling with mental illness around the world. And trust me, since the COVID pandemic, those numbers have grown greatly. That means that mental health is the leading cause of disability in the entire world. Here in Canada, almost 7 million people are suffering from mental health struggles, and one in every two Canadians have, or have had, a mental health illness by the time that they reach the age of 40. That is the real problem that is facing our society on a day-to-day basis, and yet we still point fingers, and we still don't offer help, and in the cases of many of us, we don't seek help if we can. We need to be better people. We need to protect ourselves, and that starts with our minds. We need to ensure that we are filling our minds with the right things. We need to ensure that we are filling the world around us with the right attitudes. And we need to get away from the downright anger that seemingly surrounds us in every single direction, every time that we walk out the door. Change starts with one person. And I know that there are at least a few of you goners out there that listen weekly and who make it to the end of the episode. So please, be a part of the change and don't continue to fall into the pitfalls of the world around us. We can all be better and we can all show people that we can be different. In this case, Mary Jo tried with Tyler. And it did seem like many things were starting to change inside of him after he got a little bit of help. Ultimately, it may have not been enough, or soon enough, but we all need to realize that if we truly love people, sometimes we need to make decisions like Mary Jo did, and seek help for those people, if we can, and before it's too late. I believe that the best way that we can serve the memory of Blake and Mary Jo and people like them is to learn from their cases. There are people around us, even our own children, who need help. If we can get that help to them, or at least try to help them realize that they need it, that is a win for everyone. And finally, as always, thank each and every one of you for listening to this podcast and for hanging out with me on a weekly basis. It gives me a reason to carry on, and it gives me a reason to keep doing this. Please don't forget to follow, like, share, rate, or review this podcast anywhere that you can because all of that helps. It helps with the metrics, it helps people find the podcast, and frankly, I do believe that I've been called to put this out every week to serve you a dose of true crime in the most positive way that is possible. Check us out on social media as well and get the conversation going. There are a lot of places where the conversation is oftentimes even darker than the true crime that is shared, and frankly, that's frightening. I try to buck that trend. For now, I will stop preaching and wish you all the best for the week ahead. Thank you for listening. Take care and be better.